Podcastle episode 560 for February 5th, 2019. Sudden Wall by Sara Saab. Rated PG-13. Hi everyone, and welcome to Podcastle. I'm Sheree Clark, your host today, and your new co-editor. In addition to working with the amazing Podcastle crew, I study languages and war history, which is why today's story, Sudden Wall, is one of my personal favorites. We write a lot about war and fantasy, but less about the judgments and the consequences that come after. Sudden Wall looks at that after. Podcastle is proud to present Sudden Wall, written by Sara Saab, originally published in Beneath Ceaseless Skies. Sara Saab was born in Beirut, Lebanon. She now lives in North London, where she has perfected her resting London face. Her current interests are croissants and emojis thereof, amassing poetry collections, and coming up with a plausible reason to live on a sleeper train. Sara's a 2015 graduate of the Clarion Writers Workshop. You can find her on Twitter as FortnightlySara and at FortnightlySara.com. Your reader today is me. So, unbuckle your sword, lay down some of those burdens, and enjoy the story. Sudden Wall by Sara Saab, read by Sheree Clark. In the amnesty city of Vinat, Onpanet has let guilt go. The city of Vinat is a strict and inscrutable rule master, so Panet doesn't question the rules. She lives a plain, clean life, keeps her recollections as free of the war as she can. Panet figures she has earned an indulgence or two for her decade as a soldier. Memories of Odar Harvey are one indulgence. Harvey's smile of 15 years ago, flashing in the light of the war caravan's lanterns, her easy company, their mild one-upsmanship, the unbroken sky above them. Other small indulgences Panet allows herself? Leading the stallions at Vinat's racecourse stables through their daily exercises. A now-and-then treat of salted fish and tart molasses that reminds her painfully of Camion, her home. And in this city of unremarkable languages, passed naturally from parent to child, not a drop of magic in the syllables, not the barest trace of rebellion or fury, Panet indulges in the knowledge that, at least in Vinat, the killing has stopped. 7 years after Panet's last encounter with Harvey, accidental, fraught, a neighbor appears at her door. He's here to tell her that a veteran from Panet's war caravan, Harvey, Halvey, not so easy to hear through stone, has been trapped by a sudden wall. Panet jogs a long time down dusty side streets, her throat hot and tight and dry. The morning is dull as pewter. Commotion in the city's southern quarter winds her nerves tight. The sudden walls appeared inside a house that smells exactly like Harvey, bark and new woven muslin. A crowd's concentrated at it, a seamless floor-to-ceiling curve of ochre stone that isolates a corner of the starkly furnished bedroom. There's a cocksure ruckus, as if every ex-tactician and ex-armorer in Vinat has gathered here. Fists against arcane masonry. Voices pitched to carry through stone. Battering poles hoisted, crowbars lifted. We'll get you out. How many behind there? Panet hears an answer hop from tongue to tongue. Three. There are three of them walled off by the vigilante immune response of the city. Three that Vinat has judged? Or two or one plus collateral? Three people in what must have been Harvey's bedroom. That Panet does not unpack. Panet pushes to the front, shouldering other veterans aside, rests fingertips against the sudden wall. Harvey! She shouts. The rescue party is so loud. Panet hears nothing from the other side. Questions she would ask, given time and privacy. What did you do, Harvey? How did you make Vinat so mad? Where have you been these years? question she does ask again and again. Harvey, it's Bennett. Can you hear me? And finally, from the other side, a voice she'd never forget in 1,000 years. Bennett? I'm... And something obscured, and... Help! Bennett would have helped her anyway. She can't turn away. But everyone gathered here knows that whomever Vinat meant to hold here, meant to extrude, there's no way to stand Vinat down. Not really. 3, the city is judged. Or 2 or 1, and collateral. A long time ago, Aunt Panette is 16 years old. She's still living in Camion, still growing up. She's a devoted stable hand. In exchange for riding lessons, Panette tends the beautiful purebred mares. Would do it even if there were nothing offered in return. Now that she's finished with school, she'd like to spend the rest of her life in the service of horses. She's never heard of the Rumari, only vaguely knows what the pockets are, and that invincible, unthreatened way of the young. Then Camion's Godkeep comes down. The bomb's vibrations shake the whole city. Bennett doesn't see it, but is caught in the ensuing stampede of bloodied worshippers. Moments later, she smells the destruction, sour, smoky, ancient. The greatest city in the world becomes a fragile thing. Much later, during their years side by side in the war caravan, Bennett asks Harvey about the day the Rumari bomb went off. Were you close enough to feel the blast? Harvey's brushing her horse's flank with an oiled comb. Next to her, Bennett wraps preserved rations for the next campaign. A few streets away, saw the dome shatter. Harvey stares, unfocused, into the now glossy chestnut coat. Over the tops of the buildings, the shockwave rattled my jaw. That was the day I enlisted, Panette says. It's an oddly private secret, hard to share. Harvey watches Panette in her unreadable way. The same day? Yes, Panette laughs. Hot blood. She passes a handful of pitted dates up to Harvey. When did you sign up? Harvey doesn't laugh. Camion, those days? There was nothing else for someone like me to get good at. I was headed for this war before anyone had thought of it. Bennett's quiet. She wants to say it isn't true, that this war is just a detour for them both. But the moment hangs silent until Harvey stands, clucking, to lead her horse away. During the extinction, the Camionese war machine is 100,000 strong, a sledgehammer bearing down on the brittle defenses of the pockets and the Rumari militias cowering inside. In the early days of the war, Bennett's survival and safety aren't at stake. Even guilt is more a nuisance than a scourge. Bennett has imagined her earliest encounter with Harvey 100 different ways. She is sure, in hindsight, that they'd been in the same war caravan from the start, but can't decide on the first time she noticed her. Was it a glimpse here, a quick, terse instruction there? The slope of shoulders from behind, a hypnotic rhythm during a hypnotic march? A fact she keeps snagging on. Harvey somehow avoids shaving her hair as a cadet, wears heavy black curls braided under a helmet until the day she gets a direct order to comply with regulations. Bennett would have given that order if she'd noticed. A privilege of rank. A smudge of guilt absorbed easily into the bigger body of what they'd been sent to do. The first conversation between them that she distinctly remembers. He's only 10 years old, Captain. Does he speak Rumari? Bennett asks. He won't speak at all. Bennett begins to saddle her horse. Annoyance gives her clumsy fingers. Make him speak and find out. Is this your first day in the caravan, officer? With respect, Captain, he's 10, says Odar Harvey. Her buzzed black hair hasn't settled on how it's supposed to sit. Bennett rankles at the way this upstart's insubordination courses through her chest. That's enough. Go do it. Go. She loathes it, but Panette notices Harvey after that, watches her out of the side of her eye. After a while, she still watches, but no longer thinks of the Rumari boy by association. Much later, when she dares shoulder a fraction of the crippling guilt that Venat's built to carry, brief, rare instance, Alnpanet sees the extinction for what it is. Rumari is a lean language, and Camion, the prevailing anecdote, is that Rumari has a single noun for males, females, children, and no grammar to differentiate acting, possessing, or being moved. The language is a miracle tongue, never taught, never written down. Spontaneously, children come to speak it. Youngsters too old to babble are caught mouthing gibberish into their palms. Words slip out in the solitary dark of sleep. Panette sees a boy separated from his family on the cobbled street leading to the horse market. He catches her eye, face wide and pleading, lips working in a way that pebbles her skin. It's unsurprising that, as adults, these Rumari speakers, mistrusted and persecuted from childhood, would seek out others like them. And in the lead-up to Camion's Godkeep coming down, they do. They organize. They pray in simple, over-determined words for a homeland. For Rumari to ring loud when they haggle over the price of flour. For its marching songs, unbearable noise cutting through Panette's home, to be their nightly entertainment. The Rumari annex fragmented lands on the frontiers beyond Camion. They call these lands Anakpatar, heart homes. The Camionese call them the pockets. Then the Godkeep explodes. The Rumari insurgency has struck too close to Camion's core. Panette's not the only Camionese with hot blood. In the logic of devastation, every Rumari speaker is equally to blame. The extinction. Genocide. For speaking a language. That is why Panette's guilt is too big to bear. It's 15 years prior to the sudden wall in Harvey's bedroom. Panette and Harvey arrive in Venat, part of 2 disbanded war caravans. The extinction is over. The pockets are a dead land. The war is won. Camion is safe, but its soldiers are unsalvageable. Panette and Harvey whisper about Venat through the final wet season of the war. An amnesty city being constructed at tremendous expense, product of collective remorse. There are nearly 1 million Camionese veterans after 10 years of the extinction. One day, history begins to shift, and the realization spreads, fast as the fires that raised the pockets, that they have done something terribly wrong. How could we? Genocide for speaking a language. Guilt that could crush a heart, crush a people. Venat is the best solve Camion's alchemists can muster. Panette, to her troop, in various debriefing tents on the journey from Camion to Venat. This has always been about duty. Camion called, and we answered. And you'll be able to rest your conscience. You'll be able to let the city decide what's moral, what's good, what justice is. And, forcing herself not to look for Harvey in the humid tent as thumb-thick horseflies drone against canvas, we've given a lot of ourselves for this war. Venat will accept what we are. Except for the trade-off that the alchemists of this miracle couldn't avoid. As one of its inhabitants, you're within Venat's purview. You live there, purified, but you live by new rules. If you act in a way the city deems immoral, it will act protectively. It will eliminate you from itself. Exile. Camion too scarred to take them back, but not too righteous. Maybe it's this threat that forces Panette and Harvey apart just inside the gates of the Amnesty City after the war is over. They study discharge orders to avoid looking at each other. Where are you staying? Asks Harvey. The Hall of Breath. I'm in the Hall of Joy. I'll find you after we've gotten settled, says Harvey. In Harvey's eyes, Panette sees every order she's given, the Rumari lives she's commanded to an end. Panette looks away first. She doesn't see Harvey again for 3 years. It's early in the war. Panette's a junior officer. She's only just qualified for her first warhorse, a gray gelding she'll call Aga. A year later, he'll be put down after breaking a foreleg during a tricky river crossing, just a morning's journey from the northernmost of the pockets. A few days before she swaps the sluggish packhorse she's ridden from Camion for loyal, spirited Aga, Panette makes her first kill. The Rumari's firing a repeating crossbow from a defensive outpost equidistant between two pockets. The squat bolts ping into the winter-hard, arid soil of this plain. Clods of soil flip into the air, 20 breaths from Panette, then 10, then 5. It's madness. A single Rumari fighter, the Camionese force a thick, glinting sea, pennants slack in the still morning. The war caravan extends indefinitely east from the hill Panette's been caught on. Panette's mounted. She grips her saddle painfully hard. It's the first time in the war that she fears for her life. The whiff of death is exciting and strangely illicit. Later, she'll begin to suspect that the gravest risk to her safety is ambient, the accumulation of small, self-inflicted incisions to the heart. 2 bolts ping, then no more. The Rumari topples from the rampart, downed by the arrows of at least 2 Camionese archers. Panette is the first to ride over, shield braced above her head. He's still alive, legs at wrong angles, hands clawing at the wounds in his torso. He shouts. He flaunts the language, impossible syllables, consonant-rich sounds that heat Panette's ears beneath her helmet. She hitches her weight and stabs down, one-handed through his leather mantle with her pike, through the ribs. Bone and flesh resist, but the shouting cuts short. The risk to her safety is gone, replaced with an oilier deposit in the base of her stomach. She flicks the reins and rejoins the caravan. They pull Harvey and 2 others, a man and a woman, through the sudden wall after dark. They're shaken and thirsty, arms covered in pulverized stone to the elbows. Panette hasn't had food or water either. She took a single break from the rescue effort to relieve herself hours ago and tried not to pore over every clue about Harvey's life on the table in the house's latrine. The rescue party begins to disperse, but the mood is solemn. Any reprieve from Venat's devices is temporary. Harvey looks so deflated, nothing of the soldier in her. Her eyes are downcast. Then they're searching, dancing from face to face, and then they're downcast again. At Harvey's left, as yet unnoticed, Panette puts a hand out to touch Harvey's shoulder, remembering many a steadying hand as they rode in the war caravan. Back then, muscle beneath soft armor. Now, beneath fabric, mostly the sharpness of bone. Here. Harvey turns, sees her, a slight recoil beneath Panette's palm. Captain Panette. Panette flinches. No titles here. A convention among veterans, not Venat's own rule. It is still odd to hear it broken. They drift towards the back of the crowd. Where will you go tonight? Stay with me. I need to stay with Amar and Lei, says Harvey. She finds the newly rescued pair in the crowd as she names them. You three can't be in the same place tonight, after what's happened. Unsaid, that by separating Harvey from the others, they would soon divine which of them Venat was targeting. Unasked, who are they to you? Harvey lets Panette take her home. She feeds her, gives her anise spirits to calm her nerves. After dinner, they walk to the race course, and Panette takes her to see the stabled stallions. Harvey is subdued. Every now and then, through the fog of what Venat's decided, Panette catches something. the hunch of Harvey's shoulders when she wants to be alone, or how she still favors her left leg after that long-ago fall from horseback during an ambush. The old tilt of Harvey's chin when she's shaking off a thought. Those old incisions to the heart. Burnett discovers they never healed through. When the war is over and Camion is thrashing in its own guilt, there are no informant reports of Rumari speakers for many months. This is when the war becomes known as the extinction. But the miracle tongue is a hardy thing, and after some years, there are rumors again. Then first-hand accounts of children afflicted with the language across the frontier lands, and eventually within Camion itself. The numbers are not large. It's as if the sturdy trunk is broken, and now only yellow shoots push through. Camelon begins work assimilating the few Rumari who come to the city's attention. They're taught suppression techniques, counting, deep breathing, to still their tongues. They're partnered early in adolescence to Camion's most loyal bloodlines. In the shadow of the extinction, some Rumari are not so eager for assimilation. Burnett remembers this. It's soon after they've taken the northernmost of the pockets, hard years after that first conversation with Harvey. Burnett and Harvey have not spoken words beyond commands and acknowledgments in as long as Burnett can remember. At first, she thinks it's exhaustion. Morale is low. The horses are sickly and their riders, too. Rasping coughs have punctuated the rattle-clomp of the war caravan's progress the last few nights. Burnett cannot stomach elaborate conversation either. But after weeks of this, she wonders if Harvey's okay. She watches her twice as closely, hates herself for the accounting she does of Harvey's every action. She wants to ask outright what the matter is. Her pride won't let her. Then they find a Rumari child in an abandoned home, maybe 5. She's underfed and alone, mumbling in the tongue, so scared that she soiled herself. Burnett is outraged that they cannot find the parents. The idea of executing the girl alone is an inexplicable step further than doing by rote. Mother, father, child. So Burnett takes the Rumari by the hand, away from the troop. Harvey follows, her gaze locked on Burnett in a way she's never experienced before. Burnett is thrilled by the attention, and also ashamed, that oily feeling in her stomach again. The child is in a house dress, shoeless. Flies hound her. Her wails stutter in a dried-out throat. Burnett washes her from the pail in her own tent. When she is no longer repulsed by the stink of filth, Burnett raises a finger to silence the unsettling cries and wraps a matted old fur around the child's thin neck. She glances at Harvey. Take her away, far as you can get before the sun goes down. She pins the fur at either shoulder. Find a village that'll take her. Tell them... Burnett straps the child's hair back. Tell them orders of the Camionese army to keep the child safe. Yes, Captain. Harvey looks at her in a brand new way. This is Burnett's reward. She soaks it in like sunlight. Then she pushes the little Rumari in Harvey's direction and goes back to the head of the troop. 3 years after they first arrive in Vinat, Burnett encounters Harvey on the grand steps leading down to Corner Avenue. Burnett's in a hurry, rushing to the track to watch Udu race. The young bay stallion is her favorite. He's so responsive when she gallops him, stops as soon as he's sure of the tug on his reins. She and Harvey almost collide. Vinat, a taste for whimsy? Harvey's arms are heaped with fabrics. Bolts go tumbling and unfurling down the steps. Tangerine, white, olive. Burnett scoops up 3 rolls of silk from the roadside before she sees who is carrying them. Harvey's smiling, and then Burnett's smiling too. She wants to orient this moment inside the years she's lived in Vinat. 3 years, the whole time, wondering, feelings a bit ripe, a bit bruised. But she can only think in the register of the jubilation that springs awake in her chest. Alm! Binette has never heard her given name in Harvey's voice before.
What? Where are you going with all that?
Binette asks. Harvey's smile widens. The tailor.
I'm going that way, Binette lies. Shall I walk with you?
Udo wins the race comfortably. Binette's on the other side of the city when he crosses the line. The tailor is across Binette's huge central square. They walk in silence for a time, then it rekindles. The easy company. The mild one-upmanship.
Surprised you thought you could carry all this alone, Binette says as Harvey struggles.
Strong shoulders from carrying your second quiver for a decade, Harvey says. And your shield. And your mud boots.
No. I travel light,
Binette counters, smirking at the clear sky.
You insisted on having a whole armory to hand.
Binette stops with Harvey at the door to the tailor's. She can't bring herself to ask for more of Harvey's time. Too proud. Too ashamed. So she doesn't, and Harvey doesn't volunteer it. Binette strides across the road and raises an arm in goodbye. Cutting her eyes away is like smashing the latch. The next time they see each other is the day the sudden wall appears. Harvey spends the night after the rescue in Panette's home. The hardness about her barely softens. The only familiar cues are the involuntary tells of her body. They set a mat down in the spare room, and Panette gets a single impassioned reaction when Harvey won't let Panette make a bed for her. Everything I learned in the war caravan counts for nothing, Harvey says, unless you give those sheets to me, Captain. The next morning, Binette heads down to the spare room with a glass of orange blossom. Waking up, she remembered the way Harvey would tease her about how she sat a horse. She'd exaggerate a lean to the left. You sit off balance, Captain. Until her horse whinnied nervously and other soldiers began to stare. Binette has her line ready when she rounds the hall towards Harvey's room.
Since you envied my horsemanship during the war, shall we ride today?
She stops short. Even if she wanted to go further, she can't. A sudden wall is in the way. This time, there is no doubt. There are no associates of Harvey's to share the enclosure Binette has built for her. The Amnesty City is pushing her out. Given enough time and fodder, even yellow shoots grow into trees. After a long lull in the wake of the extinction, rumors of Rumari speakers turn into rumors of Rumari agitators. On the face of it, Camion has been rehabilitated. Pacifist approaches prevail. A minister for the Rumari, ambassadors, receptions to celebrate cultural exchange. Theories appear about how the Rumari language is acquired, rekindling speculation about whether it's teachable. Scholars read treatises aloud to captive audiences gathered for horse races and concertos. There's such a glut of new studies that crowds learn to arrive later and later for public events. The assimilation isn't enough. Attacks by Rumari fighters are sporadic, but on the increase. Nothing as dramatic as the day the Godkeep came down. Nothing will ever sear into Panette's memory that way. But there are Kamianese victims. A Rumari swordsman breaks into the stalls at Panette's childhood stables, kills jockeys, kills horses. Like all veterans of the extinction, Binette pays attention to the disturbing news from Camion and the frontiers, although not too much attention. Binette is always passing judgment, and all of them worry. No one is sure what raises the city's ire. Alm Panette sounds the alarm throughout the neighborhood. A sudden wall here. Her door stays open for a stream of volunteers. The sudden wall in Panette's house is thicker than yesterday's. Vinat has redoubled efforts as she knew it would. They excavate until dark, until Panette is blinking ochre dust from her bloodshot eyes.
and though she can hear Harvey's voice on the other side, they still do not break through. Panette's hands don't falter, but she mouths, "No, no, no, no," without pause. A string of words, like a defensive stream of arrows, because otherwise she will have to accept what this means.
If Harvey stays? If Harvey stays, a sudden wall will spring up too close and crush her, or entomb her in an unbreachable thickness of miracle stone.
These deaths happen. They are not as rare as they should be. Camion's veterans have become dependent on a city that lightens burdens, antidote city to every sediment that's ever settled inside a heart. To bear its rejection is almost inconceivable. After midnight, Harvey scrambles out from behind the sudden wall. She's ashen wherever she's not covered in dust. She's barely standing.
"I was asleep," she tells Panette. "The head of my mat began to lift. I rolled away, woke, saw this,"
tips her face at the sudden wall.
"Why is this happening?"
Panette whispers as she wipes Harvey's face with a cool cloth in the latrine. It reminds her of dressing injuries in the war caravan, even Harvey's own once or twice. All of the rescuers have gone home to tell cautionary tales of the woman Vinat has condemned. Harvey's face is set, chiseled. When Panette scoops dust from the corners of Harvey's eyes, from the hollows of her cheeks, there's not a hint of emotion, not even this close up. Panette half imagines clay, not flesh, beneath the track of cloth. The only thing to indicate life is the wild black hair that's come free at Harvey's temples.
"I eliminate suspected Rumari speakers," Harvey says.
"For money. That's how I survive." Panette stops, the cloth midway between them.
"Amar and Lei are my clients," she adds.
"They work for interested parties in Camion." Panette puts the cloth down.
"All ages," Harvey says finally.
"Even children. A lot of children." There's something terrible shackled behind the control of her features, the untouchable focus of her eyes. It never undams. There's only the cutting wound to Panette's heart, incision overlaid on old incisions. Panette never moves away from Vinat. When, on occasion, she takes the stallions out beyond the city's walls, the sky is oppressive. The ground, too red-rich with the minerals left behind by the extinctions, shallow-buried dead. She forces herself to ride Vinat's circumference every so often. A reminder, she supposes, of how tattered her heart would be without the balm of the Amnesty City. Harvey survives Vinat's extrusion, leaving on a pack horse, not unlike Panette's first mount of the war effort. Panette sees her off.
Nights.
Panette dreams of Harvey being crushed. The sudden walls in these dreams are not stone, but walls of sound, walls of syllables that scald Harvey's skin as they close in on her. Waking up from these dreams, Panette recalls more and more from her years with Harvey. In the war caravan, during the extinction. These memories she sifts on her back with her eyes closed, fists knotted in her blanket. She's searching for the most untarnished of them to keep. Does Vinat know these, too? Do the memories count in her favor or incriminate her? Panette only wonders briefly, and only privately, by first light. When she hears about a new sudden wall, she tilts her chin to shake the thought away.
And welcome back. I have lived with soldiers and loved soldiers, and the reasons for fighting are as varied and diverse as they are. We all have our own battles to fight, especially lately, so choose them well. That was our show for this week. On behalf of everyone at Podcastle, our audio engineer, Peter Berevesh, our forum moderator, Aussie Cat, Assistant Editor Setsu Uzume, your co-editors Jin Albert and myself, along with all of our associate editors, Ace Ratcliffe, Aidan Doyle, Arun Jiwa, Devin Martin, Ebony Dunbar, Eleanor Wood, Hamilton Perez, Julia Pat, Julian Jarbo, Crystal Claxton, Matt Dovey, Orion Rodriguez, Craig Jackson. Thanks for listening today. And a special thank you to Kalita for all of the hard work she's done here in the castle. Be sure to share it with your friends, hit us up on social media, and if you would like to show some extra love, head over to patreon.com/EAPodcasts for special events, bonus episodes, and podcastle appearances in the wild. We'll be back next week with another story. See you then.